Welcome to Bridging the Gap. We are Alaskans discussing issues that divide us in order to find solutions that will unite us. Welcome to Bridging the Gap. Today is the 24th in a series of panel discussions of Alaskans examining issues that divide us politically in these turbulent times. My name is Paul Thomas, and I live in Trapper Creek. The objective of the panel discussion is to derive, through questions posed to the participants, an understanding of the causes that have resulted in the current polarization of American political discourse. Subsequent to achieving a satisfactory understanding of the causes, it is hoped that through further discussion, a strategy for positive interaction can be constructed, which can achieve a respectful accommodation of each side towards the other. Today we're talking about democratic processes in a constitutional republic. We have Mark Masteller coming back, Judy Donegan, and Pat Chesbro. For our own understanding and the listening audience, we need to define and distinguish the differences between a pure democracy and a constitutional, or more accurately, a representative republic. And the reason I say representative republic is because the representatives we now have don't seem to care too much about our constitutional aspects of our republic. So, if anybody wants to jump in, and I think, Judy, you have the assignment.
Well, thank you so much. As I understand it, I think you have to put constitutional in there. I think a republic is a philosophy or whatever, whereby representatives are elected, and they are the ones who determine what the laws will be and so on. And they are supposed to do that based on the tenets of a constitution. So you have not direct voting on things, but you representatives are elected to do, to make the laws, etc. A pure democracy would be, I think, unmanageable in a country this size, which would be, I've seen some things that say there does not have to be a constitution, but rather the citizens, the democratic citizens, can pass laws as they wish, basically. But I can be corrected on any of
that. Anybody want to add to that? Go ahead, Pat.
I would just add that when I was looking at things it was saying, it was talking about the fact that the more democratic processes tend to exist more in the local areas,
right,
where referendums, initiatives, those kinds of things are certainly more frequent than anything if we would do for the federal government. So what I looked at is the democratic republic, thinking that there was a, you know, and there's a lot of crossover, according to what I was reading, too, that there's nothing pure.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Mark, you have any?
No, my understanding is, you know, simply we use these representatives to make the process easier. And, you know, I guess my kind of fourth grade history or whatever grade we did that in, maybe it was longer than that, higher than that. But, you know, we had to do that when our country was young because we were spread out and it was difficult to communicate, et cetera. And now we think about it as there's a lot of people and whatnot. But I still think, and I totally agree that on the local level, it makes more sense to try to be a true democracy. But I wonder now with electronic communications, et cetera, whether we couldn't do some things more democratically. But and I'll stop there for now. Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was thinking about that. It's like, and it's true that we could manage, I think, now to count votes, to count. I was thinking about the difference between recall petitions and impeachment, for instance. And in a recall petition, you would have to count all those signatures you need to get.
Right.
And that would seem to be more pure democracy. Mm-hmm. And I think we could do that now. But it would be a pretty expensive process, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah. And we have we still have this democratic option of an initiative process or a referendum, whatever you want to use. The terms, I think, get thrown around together. But, you know, we have this possibility to do a citizens initiative like Stand for Salmon right now, which, you know, has to pass some constitutional muster. But it's the way that the citizens can have a voice if our representatives won't take up that cause for us.
That's state government.
I think a good example of the last time it was really significant in Alaska was the oil taxes referendum. And we recall how that went, right? Was that a good exercise in the democratic process with the initiative and referendum?
Well, it's a little like Stand for Salmon, don't you think, where there's a lot of big money opposing.
Bingo, bingo, bingo. Sorry.
We've been talking about that later, but it's a good point.
So, you know, is that corrupting the process or not?
Yeah, and the other initiative that I remember is the one about the cruise ship, the discharge of the cruise ships. And one of the things that kind of scuttled that ultimately was, apparently, there's some kind of a law or regulation that says, oh, in a couple of years, our Alaska legislature can overturn one of those referendums.
That's correct.
So interestingly enough, that is the antithesis, really, of a democratic republic.
Yeah. Of having a referendum overturned by the representatives.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, my understanding of the process is that if I start an initiative or referendum, the legislature has the opportunity right away to draft legislation similar or very close. And if they do, my referenda can go away. But in the case of the cruise ship, you know, that was a citizens initiative that did pass. And then you're absolutely right. Then the legislature has to wait 2 years, and then they can then modify that. Yeah.
And another recent one was the marijuana legalization referendum.
Right.
It was a referendum.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem like the legislature really has caught up as far as.
But you know, Judy's point about the oil referendum years ago and the current Stand for Salmon, it's a clear case of money in politics. And back when we had the oil one, the oil company spent $15 million or $12 million. It was a lot of money compared to what the citizens had. And now we're seeing the same thing with Stand for Salmon. It's 9-1 or 10-1 on how much money there's the development interests are spending versus what the citizens have.
Are there any historical examples of democracies, not republics, democracies that you can think of? Historic examples? I got a couple.
Go for it.
Ancient Greece.
Yes.
They did in ancient Greece.
See, I wasn't sure.
I'm not either. What's Plato's Republic?
They gathered in a forum, and they talked it over, and they made a decision. Now, if that decision required some profound organization, they appointed a leader to run the army or whatever. And here's another interesting example, the Iroquois Federation.
That's right. True, yes, yeah. That was a big one.
Very democratic, and actually our initial Articles of Confederation after the Revolutionary War was based on the Iroquois.
Right.
And they were really smart. They were matrilineal, too.
There you go. Yep.
And they seem to have New York and Upper Pennsylvania under control.
I haven't done my own research on this, but I've been told that in Switzerland they do a lot of direct democracy where, you know, there's lots of votes, they happen frequently, and you show up and vote. And I've had people say, well, you know, I'm also a little worried about direct democracy. If people are not informed and they're voting on every little thing, that could be a problem.
And how can you stay informed if there's so much going on all the time?
Yeah.
So the other thing to think about as far as democratic processes are, at least for a while in New England, a lot of town halls.
Yeah.
A lot of that kind of thing. I think that is one way of that democracy can work, is that bring people together,
bingo,
discuss things, and then the will of the people becomes a little more evident.
But the word town hall now has become synonymous
with
the representative holding the town hall, right?
I'm still going back to the unwieldiness of it. In a country this size, and I can see town halls, and even I was just looking at the Alaska recall process, So that's a citizens' initiative. I'm going a little off the subject I raised here, but there are reasons that you can file a recall petition against an elected official. But once you've done that, then there's a state official who decides whether those reasons are adequate. So that's kind of a perfect example, I suppose, of the combination. But I just can't really imagine, how do we do foreign policy democratically?
Right, yeah.
Well, one of the things, kind of going back to the whole idea of a democratic republic or a constitutional republic, one of the things that I think we have to remember is that in a functioning, and I'm not saying we're functioning right now, in a functioning democratic republic, citizens take responsibility for things that I believe we have now kind of stopped taking responsibility for. Mm. And part of that, you know, as you said earlier, is being informed.
Yeah.
I mean, I assume, rightfully or wrongly, that our representatives have more information at their disposal than I have in order to make a decision. However, I can have an opinion, I can bring up a hopefully valid point and help to say, well, maybe there's another side to think of this or whatever. And that might be, that's one way to combat the big money thing, if the representatives are willing to listen to what you have to say.
Okay, which brings me to my next question, which is to ask you to recall the discussion that you and I had when we decided we were going to have this show.
Well, I'm on the Planning Commission. So one of the things that we, I think, grapple with on the Planning Commission is that if we have, you know, we have public notice for these, you know, the CUPs that have to go out, the conditional use permits that go out, and it's announced the meeting before, and then it goes out and so on, and then people come or not to testify. And there are some that are very, bring a lot of people, and there's some that don't bring many people at all. But our question was, how do we weigh that with the staff always does a report, and so how do we weigh the public testimony? What weight do we hold the public testimony?
Or how do you even incorporate it?
And right, and knowing that even if you get, okay, so you get 15 people, which is a lot of people to come to the Planning Commission and testify. You get 15 people to testify, and yet you've got, you know, 5,000 out there that it might affect. So how do you weigh that? And how, because I think it worries us, or at least some of us on the Planning Commission, that it seems like we're disregarding what those people are saying. But we asked the attorney, and she said that each commissioner has to weigh the evidence according to what he or she thinks is important, I suppose, factual-wise, and, you know, because in order to say, no, you cannot have a conditional use permit, we have to cite the reasons
right
why we should not approve it. So it's an interesting, it's a conundrum, really, because even if you have lots of people show up, it doesn't mean that your decision is going to be the right decision, because you may be missing a piece of information that you really needed.
Or you may be given some bad testimony that you decide to include that is just not in the best.
And I wonder, though, when, I mean, I served on the Planning Commission, too, and I struggle with that, because you wonder if then you're also thinking, well, and I don't know if the attorney brought this up, but, you know, your job is to represent the good of all of us.
Exactly.
And one thing, I every time in my time there, I remember cell tower discussions. The people right next to the cell tower are really unhappy. The person with a cell tower on their land, they're thrilled because they're going to make money. And society in general kind of likes cell phones. And so to me, they were really difficult situations, because the people who show up to testify, you feel like you are disrespecting their testimony, and they showed up.
This is Bridging the Gap on KVRF Radio Free Palmer. Today we're talking about constitutional republics and democratic processes in the constitutional republic. We have Mark Masteller, Judy Donegan, and Pat Chesbrough with us today. So can you tell me what the difference is between legislating and governing? Judy talked about that a little bit earlier. What's the difference? Or is there a difference? Or are they the same thing? Two verbs, legislating, governing.
Well, the legislature legislates and all,
creates laws.
The executive and the legislature, I suppose they are governing.
So the executive governs and the legislature makes the laws that the executive uses to enforce the administration of the society that we have now.
Yeah, I would say govern might cover both branches of government.
Okay, how do the legislatures govern then?
By determining, as Pat was talking about, how they're going to vote on a certain issue that determines policy, I believe, which is, I would think, an aspect of governing.
And how do the courts then fit in?
Oh, we're going to get to the courts.
Third
later.
Branch. But I look at it, too, is that the legislator or legislatures are also hopefully gathering information or have access to a lot of information that maybe an individual doesn't that helps them make that decision. Where I struggle is, you know, does a person get into office and then stick with their own personal ideology? Or do they listen to their constituents and say, I'm going to go that way? And how do they weigh various constituents? Because I could see people saying, well, gosh, you know, I'm going to vote for this gal because she shares my ideology, and then I'm going to never talk to her because I think I like her ideology, and I'm never going to talk to her during her term in office. Or I could say, I'm going to vote for somebody who says, I have no ideas. I'm just going to listen to my people, and I'm going to take a poll every week, and I'll vote that way. And clearly neither of those happen. But right now I think we're a lot closer to policymakers sticking simply with an ideology.
Or with the base, as we like to call it.
Yeah.
So is that responsible? I think that's the other side of the coin.
Right.
Can you let those 15 people who come to the Planning Commission who may have some ideological bias one way or another, should they be allowed to control what you do, or are you under an obligation to exercise your best judgment?
Yeah.
And she would say, or the attorney would say, you are under the obligation to be consistent with your prior decisions, but also exercise your best judgment according to the information that you have gathered.
So you're saying it has to be a balance then?
I think that's the answer.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I always hope that the people who are deciding these things know more than I do. I always hope they're smarter than I am. And it makes me a little nervous when I think that they're not paying attention.
Well, I think that's the point of having staff, too. I think one would hire staff that have knowledge about those different areas, ideally, and then they could do the investigation, because there's too much to learn everything yourself, but you need to have trusted people who can go deep and give you the information. And that's, of course, in the Planning Commission, that would be the staff. The staff's responsibility is to look at the code and see if, in their judgment, things match the code.
Yeah. So if we're looking at percentages, how much would you rate? What weight would you give to the staff's work, to the Planning Commissioner's decision, and the input that you receive at these hearings? Can you kind of like give them a numerical out of 100?
Oh, I think the staff's is much. I think that's because the staff has spent the time to try to do it to code. I think they're 75% to 80% probably.
Okay. And go ahead, Judy.
Does the staff offer you just information, or do they do provide a recommendation, don't they?
Yes. Yes.
And is that a point where we should be concerned? I mean, if they're offering you information about, say, a gravel pit on my road, and I have to say I didn't always agree with their recommendation, but when they offer information, I think that's very valuable to you. How many trucks will be on the road? How much gravel is going to be taken out of here, et cetera. But when they offer a recommendation, and if that is given a lot of weight, maybe that is something I would question.
Well, what they do is they say, yes, they do recommend, with the following, you know, the caveats, for example, is the way they do it. Based on, here's what the code is, here's how we interpret each of these code things, and then based on what we've seen, either we say it meets all of these, or it meets these but not these, and so this should happen before, or, you know, that kind of thing. So I understand what you're saying.
And you have the opportunity to put conditions on.
Yes, right.
If we were specifically talking about conditional use permits, you know, since you brought it up, though, I'm curious, from my time there, how do you feel about the testimony of community councils? And here, I'll preface this by mentioning this. Years ago, probably more than 10 now, there was a concerted effort by a group or groups in the Valley to either take over or eliminate community councils. And in where I am, some of those groups took over the community council and then disbanded the community council. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to get a community council back up and running when the community council's been disbanded. But as a planning commissioner, I used to weight the community council's testimony a little bit more because I said, hey, this is the community that's affected.
Yeah.
So that was a long way of asking what you think about.
Well, I think those are really important. I also think comprehensive plans are important.
Yes.
And I think that trying to update and improve the comprehensive plans of an area, again, because the point of that process is to bring people together, not to say me as an individual don't want that gravel pit, but maybe everybody in the community is saying, I don't, you know, this gravel pit's going to do X, Y, and Z. And I think we do weigh that, but we don't always get anything from them.
Right.
Often they, if they are not disbanded, many of them don't meet frequently.
Right.
And so we have talked about really trying to go from place to place and making sure that the comprehensive plans are, try to get a streamlined way of making better, you know,
upgrading
those. My experience with community councils up in Trapper Creek, or is it a gathering of petty people that just want to throw their weight around?
At least there are people.
Wasn't my experience in Gateway area, but our community council formed because of an injustice done in our community, you know, and that's often what happens.
Yeah.
Some big bad thing happens, and then you form a community council, and then you are there. And now, as we all know, sometimes if there's no big issue, nobody shows up at a community council meeting. But then
you don't get notice either. We don't have a community council anymore. We're one of the ones that got disbanded, and we don't have a comprehensive plan, obviously.
Yeah.
But therefore, we don't know what's happening in the area.
So you think it's worthwhile to try to organize
that? I mean, we don't know through the community council. Perhaps there are other ways.
Because you don't have a community council.
We don't have them.
Yeah, so do you think it's worthwhile to try to reinitiate one in your area?
Well, so far, none of us seems to have enough energy.
It takes a lot of energy. Right. You know, this does bring up a point that I learned years ago when I was on the Planning Commission, is that the city of Anchorage actually has a person or one and a half people assigned to community councils. In other words, they actually spend a little money making sure their community councils are a viable thing. We don't do that in the Valley.
We give
councils money, but we don't have staff that kind of supports a continual council
presence.
They continue
to give revenue sharing from the state budget to community council. It's about $10,000 a year that they have.
That much, but it's something.
Yeah, but up in Trapper Creek, they were getting $10,000 a year for a while. They still are maintaining it despite our budget shortages. Okay, everybody remember Occupy Wall Street? Remember the Occupy Wall Street?
Yes.
It seemed to have some momentum at some time. It did. Can you give an analysis as to why it failed to sustain its mission? Why it fell apart?
One of the things that people said at that time was that there was no clear mission. You know, it's like starting the community council because you have a specific thing to address. If you don't have a specific thing you're trying to do, it's very difficult. If you're just against stuff versus this is what we would like to see happen, I think that's make more difficult to go on. Everybody's, well, according to what I read, many people seem to have a little different take on what they were occupying Wall Street for.
So it was a Democratic outburst with no real identified mission.
I think it's a reaction, but then when you don't have resources and you know, like Pat says, it's a matter of energy, and small groups like that don't usually have the resources or the energy, and in that case, you're fighting the people with the most money, Wall Street.
Also, the idea that people are just against something and don't have something to put in its place. I've been with organizations who have certainly been accused of that. But the way I look at it is that, for instance, the coal mine. We were against the coal mine, but I think that's being for something. It's being for the environment. Mm-hmm. You don't have to propose another economic driver, I thought. And I don't think many people see it that way, but...
Kind of like how the Republicans were against Obamacare, but really weren't for anything, just being against Obamacare.
But they're not. They're against the idea of it. You know, they like the pieces of it. It's an interesting...
To address what Judy mentioned, I think that more and more what I think about is being for healthy life support systems.
Exactly.
And when we have healthy life support systems, we can have healthy economies and communities, et cetera. It all kind of stems from that. And things like big money, you know, and short-term interests are huge threats. But if you start to step back and say, wait, what are we for? And the answer is healthy life support systems. That can be the root of a lot of things. But it's also not a big sexy thing that people want to rally around sometimes.
But it might be a messaging issue, though.
Yeah.
If you proposed it that way, would it work better than to say, you know, we don't want, say, a coal mine, a gravel pit, or whatever?
You think one of the problems we have right now is this whole idea of short-term that we seem to have.
Oh, you know, absolutely.
You've got to have instant communication. If somebody doesn't respond to your text within a half hour, you get upset. You instantly,
absolutely.
You can go to, I mean, it used to be it took a few days to buy a car. Now you can go in and then you can drive home with it.
We become do it very online. Impatient.
And I look at it for years, quarterly returns at the corporation level.
Yeah.
They worried about the quarter, not 50 yeah. years or 100 years or anything like that. Yeah.
Should the Electoral College be considered a democratic aspect of our election system or the opposite?
Well, I feel pretty strongly we need to get rid of the Electoral College. I think it had its place and it has no longer has its place anymore because of the way the technology we have today. We do not need an Electoral College.
I also think that even if we had it, rather than the winner-take-all thing, it should be percentage. You
yep.
know, if 45% of the people voted for this and
prorated.
55, yes. Yeah. Because
two states do that. Yep.
Because really, I do think it's unfair that we get three and we have hardly any people. And, you know, why do we, wait a minute, New York City take over. It's not New York City. It's the people who live there. It's one person, yeah. one vote. It's kind of out the window.
Well, yeah. The past two Republican presidents won their first terms by losing the popular vote.
Yeah.
And it was due to
that. And you know, if we were to go to a proportional Electoral College vote, I think that'd be a huge move forward. And that is governed at the state level. So we as a state could make that change.
Well, Nebraska is, and I think up in
it's
Maine.
One of the New Hampshire,
yeah,
one of the
Maine,
New England
I
states.
Think,
yeah. Maybe it's Maine. Yeah.
This is Bridging the Gap. We're here with Mark Masteller, Judy Donegan, Pat Chesbrough, and we're talking about democratic processes in our constitutional republic. Pat, you just led me into this one. And this could be a loaded question for a panel of Alaskans. But is it at all democratic for California, with 40 million people, to have the same number of U.S. senators as Alaska, that is less than a million?
They have a lot more representatives.
Okay, I knew that was coming.
I'm not sure that makes up for it, though.
There you go.
I know, the Senate's an important,
yeah.
very important place.
So more democratic or less democratic? Where we have a system where we have two senators from Alaska, two senators from California,
For me, just thinking on the Senate side of the world, I say it's less democratic because you can have a whole bunch of states in the middle of the country thinking differently than maybe the coasts, and they would control the Senate. So I say that's less democratic. But, you know, we used to have no choice to elect our senators. That was done by the representatives. The state legislature. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So at least now we do elect our senators, even though
the voters
big
can
money
directly
still
elect their senators now. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I think that was like changed in the progressive era, early 1900s.
I don't know when. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, back.
Okay. There are two prominent European examples in the first part of the 20th century where constitutional republics were taken over by fascist party leaders who eliminated elections once they firmly came to power. Everybody know who I'm talking about? We have Hitler's Nazis in Germany, Mussolini's fascists in Italy.
Right.
Given what we know happened to those two countries in 1945 and the current data we have on Trump and the Republicans at this time, do you have any concerns for the American Constitutional Republic?
Well, I've been thinking about this. I just read a book on the fall of Wisconsin. And what happened, it used to be, as we probably all know, a very progressive...
The most progressive state was Wisconsin.
Right. Workers' comp, all kinds of those ideas came out of Wisconsin. And now you look at it. And I read a couple things. And one of them's really scary in that... So you have the legislature doing corrupt things, and they were eliminated from the legislature. You have Scott Walker, who managed to avoid corruption charges somehow. But the Supreme Court as well. That would seem to be your last hope for somebody stopping some bad activity. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court is corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you do in a country like this if all three branches of government abdicate their responsibility?
Are we concerned about that based on historical parallels? I'm calling them parallels. I don't know if anyone else is going to agree with them.
Well, it's a huge concern for me, the way the country has gone. I have to say, one of my nieces sent me something that I thought was pretty positive in that it was a analysis of how when the state of California went way to the right, as far to the right as they can go, in fact, electing an actor as their governor, and that pendulum swung over there, and since that time they have not elected one statewide Republican. So the pendulum swung way back. And she sent this article to me because she said, this is the only hopeful thing I can see that might happen on the national level, that maybe our current administration will cause a big pendulum swing. But how that fits into the democratic process, I'm not going to say right now.
I think we'll see something in the midterm elections.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think we should put too much weight in all of this stuff that's happening right now. But I do think that we're going to see something in the midterm elections.
Yeah.
The people that are just sitting around and being disgusted with what's going on and not really doing anything besides not knowing what to do, I guess, besides being disgusted. I'm hopeful. I'm going to put my faith in people that they'll turn out and say, you know, we've had enough of this and we don't want this in our country.
And they might have sat out a bit in 2016.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I had a friend, actually, he was on the panel last show. And he was talking about how very depressed he was about where we are with the future of the country. And I was just thinking, ostrich in the sand, buddy. Get your head out of the sand and go do something. Help out. Vote. Don't be...
It's really tough. It's tough to see the U.S. See what we're doing with our allies and with our supposed enemies. It's a very tough situation, but how that'll play out among people who voted last election, I'll be curious to see.
How would you rate the 231-year-old experiment that is our republic? Would it help if we became more democratic or less democratic? And I know, Judy, in the beginning you were saying about how it's, you know, the pure democracy is sort of unworkable, and I think we all agree with that.
Yes, but more democratic. For instance, the Electoral College, I guess eliminating that would make us more democratic.
And improve.
And I think improve the situation.
But I have to go back to what I was said earlier. You know, we also need to be more conscious of what we as citizens should be doing. You know, one of the things, my son is running for state house, and where, you know, he doesn't have a primary opponent. And one of the things that I learned when I ran for office is that people don't know what's going on. They say they don't vote. Some people say they don't vote because they don't know what's going on. Other people haven't really paid any attention yet to what's going on. So the question would be, when can you get to people and what do you say to people so that they don't rely on that D or that R or that I or that N or whatever kind of letter is behind the name? Because yeah. I think one of the things is we have not. And I think it's difficult to find out information right now. I think it's a flurry of things that you have to sort through. And I was a teacher, and I tried to teach the difference between fact and opinion, and I'm not sure everybody knows.
And I guess I'll address your question, Paul, by saying I think we're failing right now. And the primary reason for me that we're failing is that is because of Citizens United and money in politics. So, and that didn't just happen overnight. There was a structure built a couple hundred years ago that favored certain people, and with the accumulation of wealth and whatnot. And I would just suggest there's two books, Dark Money, great book, and also Born on Third Base. And Born on Third Base especially is really good about talking about how some people have advantages who don't even know they have advantages, and also how the 1% can control everything. I mean, when in 2016, the Koch brothers said they were going to spend $900 million. This year, they said they're going to spend $400 million on elections. There's no citizen group or anything can match that kind of stuff. And we have these oligarchs who have a huge share of wealth.
And there's also the move toward privatizing schools and so on, and undercutting the public education system is not helping in this whole situation. And I read about a lawsuit where, you know, there is no constitutional right to education in the United States. That's a Supreme Court decision from quite a while ago. But people are now trying to frame it that if you don't have an educated citizenry, you have disenfranchise them, yeah, because they cannot sift through things and get information. So that's another front that the Koch brothers and so on they don't want people to vote. They don't want people to know what they're voting on.
So how do you rate the experiment then, Judy?
Are we back on this country as an experiment?
Yes. I just wanted to get your answer to that because I got the other two answers.
Well,
doing all right, or Mark said we're failing.
Well, I think we have done all right in various times, and the pendulum has swung back and forth. I'm a little afraid we shouldn't just be relying on that to happen again.
That's right, absolutely.
Because it does look, maybe I'm just pessimistic, but this looks really bad to me. And it might be that the framers of the Constitution, brilliant as they were, thought that the people who would participate in government as representatives and as the president and so on would have what John Kasich called the other day the essence of America. And I don't think we have that now. Too many people in the federal government do not have that. And I worked in the courts for 30 years, so I have this kind of feeling that the courts should save us. But the courts can't save us if bad people are confirmed.
And I think part of it, really, the whole money issue, and the whole issue of no term limits for our legislative body, I think that's a huge issue. I think they are so important for them to keep those jobs, and the only way they're doing it is this ongoing onslaught of money. But it's not just money, it's language. It's the language that we have adopted according to, you know, they give us the language and we keep saying fake news instead of propaganda. I mean,
that's a good point.
We really need to think about what we're saying, and instead of calling it pro-life, call it pro-birth. That's what it is. They want the children to be born. They don't appear to give a rat's interest.
In what, rats have interest, eh?
Yes. I did see, though, that some horse is now suing its owner because it was not treated well.
I think
that'll be interesting if we get corporations or people.
Horse? Is there an attorney?
If corporations are people, I wonder if horses are, too.
Yeah.
There is sufficient evidence to conclude that the Republican Party is the Trump Party. I know Mike might disagree with that. At least he did a few months ago. Senator McConnell refuses to allow a vote on any legislation to protect Mueller from Trump. That is the legislative part of the Republican Party. But in my mind, the most significant portion of the party owned by Trump is the registered Republican voting electorate. That force scares the bejesus out of Republican politicians because even the perception of crossing Trump could get you primaried out of the picture. While it is generally accepted that voting in elections is the most democratic exercise the people can do, can we believe that Trump's control of the Republican electorate is the result of the manifestation of democratic principles in this republic?
There's plenty of Republicans who are not happy. So I have a hard time.
The polls I've been hearing is close to 90% of the Republicans.
That might be 90% of his base, but it's not 90% of Republicans, I don't think. But anyway, if you look at Republican columns and, you know, opinion columns and whatnot, there's plenty of people that are not happy with how things are going.
Steve Schmidt, George Will. Guys like that you talk about?
Sure.
They quit the party.
There you go. But I guess my point was going to be getting back to things like dark money. There were strategies developed to get people to vote against their own economic self-interest, basically, by using things like immigration and
abortion
as issues to get those people to vote one way that just basically kept the oligarchs in power.
Yeah. What's the Matter with Kansas by Thomas
Frank?
There you
go. I haven't read that yet.
It's simple, short, amusing, and it's probably somewhat dated, but still, that's the concept. Why are these people voting the way they do? And it is voting against economic interests.
What year was that? Did that come out?
Who?
Was Brownback?
It's at least
the
2 years ago.
I don't think he was.
It's about 2 years ago that book came out.
No, it's longer than
longer
that.
Longer than that? Okay.
Yeah, I would say 10
years
maybe.
So, Pat, what do you think about it? Trump controls the Republicans or not?
I think we're right in saying that he has such a vitriolic tweet that if you do anything that he doesn't like, or if it appears that you are not kowtowing to him, he's going to excoriate you. And I'm of the opinion that we should not publish his tweets anymore. I mean, I think we don't need to know what he's saying. That just gives him the kind of power that he wants. But I think the Republicans in power are afraid they will lose power if they say something against him. And that's why we're seeing so many people leave the Congress now, because they apparently wanted to say something bad again, say something honest about Trump, and they knew they wouldn't withstand it if they did.
Yeah. Well, they're being primaried, though. You have to look at those election results, and the Republican primaries are showing that the Trump supporters are beating the people who aren't as enthusiastic about Trump, the more mainstream Republicans. Go ahead, Judy. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that this didn't just start since What's the Matter with Kansas was published in 2004. So that's quite a long time ago. But anyhow.
Voter suppression is a phrase that has been bandied about lately. purging the registration rules of voters, voter ID, reduction of polling places in certain minority-populated areas causing long lines on Election Day are some of the alleged examples of voter suppression. Are these legitimate accusations? Is voter suppression really occurring?
Yes.
Okay. What does that tell you about the direction this republic is heading in terms of the democratic principles?
Money talks.
It seems like they're very smart, these people with the money. You have to give them credit. I mean, they've approached this from all angles: voter suppression, privatizing education.
It's a long game.
It is a long game, and that's what's so scary about it, because you can attack one thing, and then something else they've done pops up.
And the longest game, I think it was it today's paper, Charles Wolforth? He points out every single U.S. Supreme Court judge went to either Harvard or Yale.
Mm-hmm.
And they are political appointees. There's nothing, you know, nonpartisan about our Supreme Court at all. And they're appointed for life.
Which brings us to the next question. On June 25th, 2013, the Shelby County versus Holder decision, the Supreme Court struck down portions of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which required certain states pre-approval before making any changes to voting procedures. Since that decision in 2013, 23 states have enacted voter restriction legislation, according to the Brennan Center for Justice of New York University Law School. And, of course, what we were talking about earlier, Mark, the Citizens United decision, which opened the faucet of dark money from secret, undisclosed sources into politics. Are the courts supporting or restricting democratic processes?
Well, the courts are responsible for Citizens United.
Mm-hmm. So that's right.
There you go. And they're also upholding voter ID laws. I have to say, excuse me, I worked for a judge on the Seventh Circuit. And one of the really early voting rights cases was in Indiana. And the Seventh Circuit upheld Indiana's restrictions.
What year was this?
Oh, boy.
you can ballpark that.
maybe 2000, early 2000s.
Okay.
excuse me. But anyhow, the judge I worked for back then before anyone was talking about this, wrote a dissent and said, this is all to suppress Democratic votes. It's to suppress the black vote. It's to suppress this and that. And nobody really was saying that at that time very much. That case went to the Supreme Court, which upheld, actually, I think it was an en banc hearing first, but it went to the Supreme Court, which upheld the Seventh Circuit's upholding of the Indiana restrictions. And the Supreme Court upheld the restrictions as well. And then several years later, after all of this became more apparent to everybody, Justice Stevens and Judge Posner on the Seventh Circuit both wrote articles or whatever, or gave speeches saying, you know, Judge Evans was right. The reason for this was voter suppression. So it seems like the courts can be a little slow to see what's going on sometimes. But right now,
then maybe they do see and they want to go with it.
Well, and that's, I think, maybe going to become more and more apparent. Trump has appointed more Court of Appeals judges in the first 2 years than any other president. I just read this somewhere. Any other president has. And
because they wouldn't do it with Obama, says that one?
Well, because Obama, McDonald was dragging his feet over these. And then once Trump became president, let's have hearings.
And that's how he could do it, because they wouldn't confirm anyone. The judge I worked for took senior status in 2009, and his replacement was just appointed this year. 9 years that seat was empty.
Jeez, wow.
and Obama had.
The entire Obama administration.
Yeah, and Obama had nominated two, maybe three people who didn't get hearings, who didn't get anywhere. So if they hold those seats open, now they're all open, now they can be filled. And you've got, I have to say, I know the guy that got appointed to this seat. He's not the worst person in the world. I couldn't have a fit about that. But a lot of them are, and they all have a Federalist Society way more conservative bent than the people they're replacing.
But it makes me wonder, too, though, that the job of our legislative branch at the federal level to be a kind of a check and balance on the executive. And right now we don't see that.
No.
And, you know, but I think that whether you're Senator Murkowski or Senator Sullivan, that should be part of your thought process is what's for the best of the people. I certainly don't see that necessarily. But
I don't think we see that in very many places.
Yeah.
And it's a little scary in the executive branch. Like, does anyone there ever consider what is best for the country or what is best for our survival or what is decent? It doesn't look to me like they do.
It seems to me that they're bent on destruction, destroying anything that has been done over years to try to establish those kinds of things. And to say that, oh, we don't need this regulation because it's fixed. Regulations come about because people don't act responsibly almost every time. I mean, it's not like, oh, we made a law just because we felt like it. No, we made a law because someone did something that
happened.
Said, right. Oh, we need you to have some regulation about this. And so now we have the regulation, and now, oh, it's all fixed, so we don't need the regulation anymore. And that is just, that is denying how people are greedy and self-serving, I think. And I think we should just admit that people are.
Well, and for me on the local level, it's an example of how we in Alaska have the opportunity to learn from so many other communities that have been around a lot longer. And we refuse to do so, but partly because we have a lot of people who are here simply for short-term personal gain. And when things get bad, they're going to leave. And they don't care about, you know, don't tax my income in the near term because I'm not retiring here. And so we're going through that kind of bubble, I think. And again, obviously, I'm a fan of land use planning, but we could look ahead and do some things. And we try every now and then. And a lot of people, and you probably have seen this, but I clearly remember instances where somebody would say, I moved here because I didn't want any rules.
Yeah,
and now
exactly.
My neighbor is doing something that I'm not happy about, and I want a rule.
That's right.
And then
exactly.
I realized the rules I had at where I used to live made a little bit of sense.
They weren't such bad rules after all. We are bridging the gap here with Pat Chesbro, Judy Donegan, Mark Masteller talking about constitutional republics and the democratic principles that govern them. There are a lot of issues where the will of the people is ignored by the representative branch of government. I think we already brought a few of those up today. But none more so than the issue of background checks for gun possession. This November is the first national election since the Parkland, Florida massacre. These kids have been doing a lot of organizing. Can we measure how effective those efforts are?
I don't think you'll see any effect in Alaska. If that's just my opinion. I'd be curious to know if it happens anywhere else.
Be interesting if it happens in Florida.
Yeah.
It did happen to some degree, didn't it, in Florida? Yeah. Is that what you said?
Sorry. Yeah. Well, I think to some degree, but I'm not sure. Remember,
Rick Scott did sign a bill that said that over the 21, you couldn't buy an assault weapon unless you were 21. That was one of the things in that legislation.
Yeah, I don't know if they'll do anything. They're a very sympathetic bunch, those kids, I think. They're very admirable. I think that a lot of people respect and are kind of amazed at what they've done. And maybe they just open the conversation a little more. But are we really going to do anything about assault weapons? Or?
So you don't think that their organizing efforts are going to pay that many dividends?
I think the dividend is going to be with the young people who organize. I mean, I think that if young people see what these young people have done and how articulate they are and how forward-thinking they are and how active they are, I think that may encourage more young people to be actively involved in whatever kinds of things they want to be, whether it's gun control or something else. What is it, the kids that have the lawsuit about the environmental
climate,
thing?
Yeah,
climate change?
Right. Yeah.
Well, and I think that's a good point because, and it also shows how smart these kids are, I think, because they have switched some of their effort toward voter registration and, you know, we're going to be 18 in November and trying to get people registered. So while that might not have an effect immediately on assault rifles, it could have a long-term effect.
And you could actually see a bunch of folks, young folks, with the social media actually countering big money, I think. You could actually see a swing like that.
So you think the Parkland mastery of the social media medium is going to have an effect then? Positive effect?
I think those young people, because that they of course were brought up in social media, I think they are the people. But I also think this is a good indication of what a good education system can do.
Good point.
Those children,
that's true.
Those young people are articulate. They are forward thinking.
David Hogg already wrote
amazing.
A book with his younger sister.
Wow.
I know.
Right.
I know. So that's
that's
a good
point.
School system.
Okay.
Yep.
I want to thank
that's
Mark and Judy and Pat. It's been a wonderful discussion. And to all you listeners out there in Radio Land, thanks for listening. Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Bridging the Gap. We welcome diversified perspectives. If you are interested in becoming a panelist for a future show, send us an email to manager@radiofreepalmer.org.
This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters.